From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When bird flu last threatened the world in a big way, health officials wondered how bad it could get and how to be ready. They commissioned researchers to find out. They did. With just a few lab mutations, they created a super lethal form of the flu. Now the government wants key elements of that research locked away, put in a new category of secret science. This hour on Point, science, security, and the superflu. You can join the conversation. When should science be kept under wraps? How do we push forward human understanding and human safety at the same time? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from top administrators, ethicists, and the editor of Science Magazine, who's been weighing what to do with the deadly insights of this research. But joining us first today from New York for the facts of the matter is Robert Bozzell, chief science and health correspondent for NBC News. Robert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thomas, my pleasure.
So we all remember the bird flu scare of a couple years back. What in the aftermath happened around research that's got everybody in a tizzy now?
Well, the bird flu scare began in 1997 in Hong Kong when a virus that infects birds, which was found in chickens to be jumping to some human beings.
Mm-hmm.
A very high case fatality rate, something like 60% of the people who got it died, and a lot of other people got very sick. And in that instance, the Hong Kong authorities stopped that epidemic by killing all the chickens in Hong Kong, and we remember those pictures. And interestingly enough, it just happened again, coincidentally, with this story a few days ago.
Great.
When it showed up in the marketplace in Hong Kong, and they killed a lot of chickens around it to keep it from possibly spreading to humans. But the thing about bird flu that became clear pretty quickly was that as dangerous as it was when it did infect people, it didn't seem to transmit very easily between people. So there would be an occasional case where it would affect one person who was around chickens and then maybe a second person, but there was never a chain of infection that would lead
right
to an epidemic or, of course, a pandemic. And that was the key about this particular flu, H5N1. And ever since then, that initial Hong Kong outbreak, there have been outbreaks of this virus throughout mostly Southeast Asia, but in other parts of the world. And again, the same thing has always happened. A few people get infected, 60% of them or so die, and then the thing goes away in human beings.
So the nightmare scenario would be if this were hopping from mammal to mammal here, human to human, and suddenly you've got a pandemic, and the government financed research, Robert, to see exactly what it would take to make that happen.
Exactly. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease paid for research grants for scientists to study what genes needed to be changed in these viruses to make them transmissible so that they would be more easily moved to human beings. And they tested it in the primary animal model for human transmission of influenza, which is ferrets. And for reasons that are not clear, ferrets are the best model. They transmit the flu the way humans do.
So first question, we'll look at that. And they went to the University of Wisconsin, to Yoshihiro Kawaoka there. They went to the Netherlands, the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, asked them to do this. Why do this? Why create what could itself be the superbug?
Well, I think that the reason is that you want to find out what genes are changing in what direction before this thing becomes really serious. That's at least what the people who paid for it and the people who want to do it are saying.
This would be so that we could prepare for that possible eventuality in nature?
Let's say scientists from the World Health Organization and other groups are taking isolates of viruses around the world all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And these days it's fairly easy to quickly characterize them genetically. And you want to find out if it's starting to change in a way that's going to make it more transmissible. In other words, should we start to get worried about this particular outbreak in Vietnam or in Thailand or some other country? And that is, so it's more of a question of what we should be looking for. So you create it in the laboratory, and then you know what changes. And, of course, it turned out that the changes are surprisingly few, and I think the scientists on the panel could probably answer that better, but it seems like it's not that hard.
You're talking genetic mutations that
the
they created in the lab.
Would have to to occur in nature to make this more transmissible than it has been.
So the threat, presumably, I guess, we'll ask, but may be there in nature because they could see in the laboratory how few steps it would take in terms of mutation for this thing to become much more transmissible between human beings. All right, so they yes?
And if you take garden variety flu that we get every year or the swine flu that we had in 2009, those were both very transmissible, particularly the swine flu in 2009 among people, younger people, and that's what made them particularly dangerous. But fortunately, though that virus was not as lethal as H5N1 is in human beings, in the great flu pandemic of 1918, which was when H1N1 first swept around the world, the fatality rate was something like 2%. So here we're talking about a 60% fatality rate,
oh my gosh.
And it boggles the imagination.
Utterly.
What would happen if this got into the general population?
That's like a flu plague. So here we go. The researchers do it in Wisconsin and Rotterdam. It's not classified research. So once they've done it, they ship their research off in the way that science works to Science Magazine and Nature, and they're ready to publish these things. And the government who financed it steps in and says, wait, no, please don't give all that away because that could be the keys to bioterrorism.
Well, I think that what happened in this situation was that there just was a missing step in this. And the NIH, which paid for this, had not thought this through completely. And I don't mean to put any blame on anybody here. But when the CDC pays for similar research, which is called what's in dual-use applications. In other words, it could be used for good, for understanding something, but it also could be used to harm people.
Yeah.
There has to be approval beforehand and a discussion beforehand about how this information is going to be presented publicly. That discussion didn't take place beforehand in this case. It didn't take place until it was almost out and everybody when the two journals were about to publish it. And that's why this is an unusual case, just because it got so far.
It's a kind of first of a kind in that way. I mean, the word being used here is censor, though you can understand why, certainly when they talk about the characteristics of
these. It isn't censored because this government panel that makes these recommendations doesn't have the power to censor anybody. And they are only recommending two things, that the papers be published in a way that doesn't give the cookbook, actually, the materials and methods for anybody else to use it, which, of course, is the thing that you would worry about. And the second thing is that then a mechanism which has not been determined yet be set up so that scientists around the world who have a need to know for real about this and are not have no intentions of doing harm, they can get their copies of this in a way that everybody is satisfied that it won't lead to any danger of bioterrorism.
Well, we'll see about that. I mean, once there's information, it tends to travel. You say, Robert, it's not censorship, but, everybody has their own interpretation here. That's the word that's used right in the lead of the story in The Guardian about this. Here is, I got a little tape of Anthony Fauci. This is of the National Institutes of Health, which oversees the government's biosecurity board, telling here the BBC that the general public should not have access to the recipe for a deadly virus.
This virus can attain the characteristics of spreading rapidly and being able to have a high degree of virulence. That fact will be published, but not every single person needs to know how to make a lethal virus. I don't think the general public, particularly if some of them might have nefarious reasons, should have a blueprint or a roadmap about how to make a lethal virus.
No roadmap, please, for the general public on how to make a lethal virus, but then that leaves us with all kinds of questions about how science itself is pursued. Robert Bozell is chief science and health correspondent for NBC News. He's been with us from New York. And, Robert, thank you very much for getting us in here. Thanks for your introduction.
My pleasure.
Joining us now from San Francisco, one of the principals in this whole case, Bruce Albert, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. This week, the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity recommended that the magazine withhold details that would enable replication of the bird flu experiments by those who would seek to do harm. Bruce Alberts, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Were you expecting this request from the moment this research landed on your desk with the cookbook for, pandemic?
Let me back up a second, because right after 9/11, the National Academy of Sciences set up a committee that produced a report that actually led to the establishment of the National Security Advisory Board for Biotechnology. And So this group recommended many things, the Academy report, including the fact that journals like ourselves, when we see such a paper, should get special advice on security matters. And so it's not true that we were about to publish it until we heard from the NSABB. We had already sent our papers out to selected scientists to ask them specifically these questions. In fact, some of those scientists were intentionally chosen because they were experts who were on the NSABB, the advisory board.
Does that mean you might have withheld this information even without any intervention from the government?
Well, that's right. So basically, we are very pleased that this advisory board exists, and we have been waiting for months for them to come to a decision because we recognized from our own reviews that this was a serious matter that needed their attention.
You say you're very pleased, but I'm looking here. This is Professor Wendy Barclay, Chair of Influenza Virology at the Imperial College in London, saying, it's a very worrying idea that information from this type of work may be restricted to those that qualify in some way to be allowed. She says, who will qualify? She talks about a danger of beginning a Big Brother society. On the other hand, there's a pandemic threat. But you know, you've got academics right. Who feel a little queasy about this.
Of course. I mean, this breaks a long tradition of openness. It's very important in science. And we have been refusing the journals to go ahead and publish a redacted version as requested until the government sets up a transparent mechanism that will assure us and others that the scientists who need to know will get the information.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about secret science, laboratory-bred super bird flu, a potential global super killer, and government moves to keep research under wraps. This is following up on the bird flu epidemic. They paid for research to see how much worse it could get, how it could get worse. The scientists figured that out. When it came time to publish, please, let's not put that in the papers. Here is Dr. Amy Patterson on tape, a director of science policy at the National Institutes of Health, saying the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity recommended publishing the results of a superflu experiment, but not the methods, not every detail.
The idea here is to publish the general conclusion, but to not publish the methodologic details and the details of the sequence information that would make it easy for someone to misuse this approach in a way that would threaten public health.
That sounds quite reasonable. At the same time, scientists are wondering exactly how this is going to work. The publications themselves, and we have the editor-in-chief of One Science magazine, Bruce Alberts, with us from San Francisco today, waiting on publishing a redacted form of this research until it's explained to them how this might work. There's a long tradition of open exchange of information. On the other hand, who wants a pandemic? And certainly the concern here is that we get into the hands of, as you heard, those with nefarious intentions. Bruce Alberts in San Francisco, what would you like the government to lay out for you before you go ahead and publish this limited version of the research?
Both editors have been working together.
This is you and Nature magazine.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Nature magazine and Science magazine have been pushing back on the government to say that basically we can't publish a redacted version until there is a transparent mechanism that allows scientists anywhere in the world who have a need to know to apply for this missing information that's left out of the manuscript. And my understanding is that the government's been working very seriously on developing a mechanism. We all recognize that in the long run, the mechanism should be an international one involving the World Health Organization or somebody else, but we can't get that up and running quickly enough. And so we're hoping and anticipating that the U.S. government will have a approved process that involves international scientists, which they must be involved, closely involves them, but which is able to get instituted by the time that we publish these papers.
Can you explain for our listeners who may be thinking to themselves, well, who on earth do you want to have this information if it could hypothetically create or materially create a pandemic? Who would it be around the world and around the country in research labs that you would imagine as eligible to dig into every little, titch and tottle of how to do this?
Sure, Tom, I'm happy to do that. Let me frame this in the context of one of my other jobs. It's a volunteer job. I've been science envoy to Indonesia for President Obama.
Okay.
Indonesia is one of the countries that's most involved here. It's a place where they have a problem, people dying from this disease.
Yep.
And we need to get information to the appropriate people in Indonesia who have to be on guard for some of the mutations that have been observed popping up naturally in the environment.
Because they're on the front line, in effect, here.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I want to stress that what was done in the lab is basically to speed up evolution, but there's every reason to think that the same kind of evolution can occur naturally in the wild, and that's why the research was done, of course. So we have an obligation, both to the world and Indonesia and to science, to make sure that the information we need to protect Indonesia and the world public, because if it starts in Indonesia, it's going to spread everywhere else, from having this happen naturally. And now, of course, it may happen, involve other mutations than those that we know about, but at least we're arming them with this information that will help scientists in Indonesia catch early stages of this evolution process.
So do you really think that you can put this out in the science community or even just out broadly in your magazine, sort of dancing around the really critical crown jewels of this information, and that it doesn't eventually come out on its own? I mean, can you really bottle up science? If you point the general direction, you got a lot of scientists and they're smart. Aren't other people going to figure it out?
Well, of course, eventually this will come out. What we hope, that in this case, for example, that suppose it came out in the general public in 3 years, that we would have done enough work to prevent this kind of virus from being spread by new kinds of drugs, new kinds of immunizations, that when it does leak eventually, and maybe it's 10 years from now, that this will not be the kind of problem it would be that if it leaked now. And I assume that eventually this information will, as you imply, be out in public knowledge.
Bruce Alberts is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Here's a little tape. This is from the lead researcher in the Netherlands. This is Ron Fortier telling the BBC yesterday about the positive public health impacts that could come from this research, creating a super flu that could be easily transmitted between mammals, and how it will help people think about how to deal with bird flu.
It's probably going to mean that the outbreaks in poultry will be handled a little bit more strictly than they have been handled so far. And secondly, we have identified the changes in the virus that can cause this virus to go airborne. And these changes can now be monitored in the field. And we will be able to evaluate the antiviral drugs and vaccines to see if they would also work against this airborne virus.
Okay, so we get it. It's a heads up to how few steps would be required in genetic mutation for this to happen, how we might handle it if it came, how to handle poultry in the meantime to minimize the risk of this. And still, you wonder about the security. And then, on the other hand, you wonder about the freedom of science. Bruce Alberts is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, right in the middle of this, joining us from San Francisco. Bruce, stand by for a moment, if you would. Donald Henderson joins us right now from Baltimore, distinguished scholar at the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. He served as the first director of the Office of Public Health Emergency Preparedness, and later as principal science advisor in the Office of the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. He's co-editor-in-chief of the peer-reviewed journal Biosecurity and Bioterrorism. Donald Henderson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Let me ask you first about the research itself. Do you think this was necessary, important, a good idea to figure out how this could mutate and become more dangerous?
Yes, I would say I think it's a good idea, but I'd like to put something in perspective here, and that is the nature of the virus we're talking about related to that which would be other agents which we're concerned about, either new or emerging agents. This is far beyond, I think, anything that we have imagined. A virus that could spread rapidly like influenza, no other virus spreads with this speed, could go worldwide. Secondly is the case fatality rate, which is running between 50 and 60%.
Are you talking, may I ask, I'm sorry, Donald, the fatality rate of the laboratory-created bird flu mortality
I'm talking about the natural, the natural infections.
Yeah.
We see the end mm-hmm. of most of them one or two cases at a time.
Because it's not so easily transferable now, but very deadly. I get it. Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And when we look at other biologic agents, whether we're looking at smallpox or anthrax or plague, and look at the case fatality rates with those, they're far, far lower than what we're seeing with this influenza.
So this is super dangerous stuff.
It is super dangerous. That, in my opinion, it is unique, and probably it's the worst one can imagine. Some have talked about Andromeda strain characteristics. Well, whatever it is really a serious problem.
But you wrote, along with Tom Inglesby and Anita Cicero, in a recent editorial, you said, should we purposefully engineer avian flu strains to become highly transmissible in humans? In our view, you wrote, Donald Henderson, no. But we've done it.
Well, and it's done. So you now have a situation which is very chancy. I think, in fairness, it's not so much engineering that they're trying to do so much as they were looking to see how the attributes of greater transmissibility might be come about. In that case, I think it was very sensible work. I don't think myself that most people thought that we would see an end result such as this, but the end result we do have. So then looking at this in terms of what is published or not published, I would say this has to be looked upon, in my opinion, as something quite unique because we're doing a fair amount of work with a number of different agents which have varying potential, but they're very different than with this strain of flu, the bird flu, which is transmissible.
This one so dangerous that the government has asked the scientific journals not to publish the key elements of this research. But they're asking for, well, how can we make it available over time? How can the science still flow? And you can see this meeting of security and scientific concerns is really a fraught one and interesting. Paul in Cambridge, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think this is one more example of our technology far exceeding our wisdom to use something in a responsible manner.
What's your field, really, Paul? What field are you in, sir?
Pardon?
What's your field?
Molecular biology.
Okay. So you know what you're...
And as a research scientist myself, I feel that there are a large number of my colleagues who are so obsessed with seeing if they can do something without asking the basic question, should they do it? It makes me very squeamish knowing that these viruses or bacteria are being re-engineered into something far more powerful than they were simply to satisfy some scientist's curiosity or because they get a fair amount of grant money from the Department of Defense. It's foolish to think that if these data are not published in a scientific journal, it's foolish to think that they will not get out eventually. Look at Wikipedia and the military secrets. I mean, it will get out. It will be in the hands of someone who wants to use it in a very destructive manner, and it makes me very, very uncomfortable, not only as a scientist, but as a citizen, to know that this is going on.
Paul, stand by there for just a minute if you'd be so good. I want to play a little tape from a fellow scientist, not a colleague of yours, but another researcher, one at the heart of this. And this was the Dutch researcher, Ron Fortier, talking with the BBC yesterday, kind of suggesting that the U.S. government, in clamping down on the information, had overreacted to this study. Listen to this with us, Paul and Bruce and Donald. Here's the Dutch researcher, Fortier.
There is potential dangers to everything in life, but it would be pretty hard for anybody to repeat this work without having a specialist group of people doing this work. You could not do this type of work in your garage as an individual bioterrorist.
Paul, caller Paul, you're in molecular biology. He says, hey, there's dangers to everything. Settle down. You couldn't do this in your garage.
It sounds like my Dutch colleague is underestimating the power and the resources of different terrorist groups who perhaps he thinks they're operating out of their garages in these small terrorist cells. These are extremely well-funded, well-financed, and these are extremely intelligent people. And I think it's rather foolish to think that they would not figure out eventually how to do something like this.
Paul, I appreciate your call. Donald Henderson, I mean, could this ever be used by a bioterrorist? Wouldn't it put all of their own allies at risk as well? I mean, these things go global. How could anybody use it without sort of signing their own death warrant?
Well, in a way, you're right there. But on the other hand, I think what we're concerned here, too, is that someone develops this agent and there's an accident. It escapes, and no laboratory is perfectly immune to an escape. And you've got the virus is loose. What we should be doing and what we have not yet really put enough emphasis on is accelerating the pace by which we can develop influenza vaccines.
Yeah.
And to and have a capacity to do this on a scale that can do something for the world.
Does this research prepare us to do that more quickly and effectively, to develop those vaccines, or is it on a different track?
I can't see that this particular research would have an impact there. I do believe it might have an impact in getting more resources and a sense of urgency put into the development program for vaccines.
Bruce Albert,
antiviral drugs.
Bruce, you're an editor. I mean, you publish science, and we should note the publication of scientific research, peer-reviewed scientific research over decades and decades, is exactly what has helped us push the scientific frontier forward. But you hear our caller Paul, molecular biologist, calling in from Cambridge, saying, you know, there's some things you should just never do. You shouldn't be doing it. How do you feel about it? Shouldn't be doing it? Shouldn't be writing up the research? Shouldn't, certainly, I guess, in his view, publishing. How do you feel about that as a publisher of scientific research, Bruce?
Well, two different groups involved here. The National Institutes of Health, which funded this particular research in both cases, both our paper and the one at the other magazine. Then there's the community of publishers who, as I've stressed, have been alerted to this following 9/11 and are very much aware of the need to be careful. The issue for us really is that, and for me personally, is that from a immediate post 9/11 study from the National Academy of Sciences, this National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity was established with really outstanding expert scientists on it, mixed with security experts. And to me, this is the best possible mechanism I could imagine for making these very difficult decisions.
But what about our caller Paul's question? Why was this research done in the first place? Is it worth it? Because we can't guarantee where information goes once it exists. Or is that just anti-science to think that way?
Well, you know, I think that's a fair question, and that's a question really for the National Institutes of Health who funded it. To take Don's point, now I think with this result, the result being the surprising ease with which this virus can mutate to be really incredibly dangerous as far as we can tell. That should really cause a redirection, in my mind, of resources to work against this bird flu possibility, transmitting freely in aerosols.
Yeah.
And so I would like to see I don't know if this is going to happen, but, post 9/11, for example, the Academy set up a special committee to study how we could make antivirals against smallpox, which at that point was the top priority.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about secret science, laboratory-bred super bird flu, a potential global super killer, and government moves to keep research, under wraps, at least the key portions of it. We've been talking with Bruce Alberts, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. This is one of the two that the government has now come to and said, hey, we want to redact that. We want to hold certain elements of the data and scientific methods around this genetic mutation of bird flu that made it much more easily transferable. And this is a flu with a, you know, 50, 60% mortality rate. We want to keep that out of your magazine. They're negotiating right now about how to do that. Donald Henderson is with us, co-editor-in-chief of the peer-reviewed journal Biosecurity and Bioterrorism, Biodefense Strategy, Practice, and Science. He was first director of the Office of Public Health Emergency Preparedness from 2001. He's now at the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Joining us right now as well from Stanford, California, is bioethicist Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford University. He's worked in departments of defense and energy. Hank Greeley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All kinds of questions being raised for our listeners here. Let me put one to you, if I may. This is off our website, Hank. Gene writes, what are the medical ethics of tailoring diseases to make them worse? Hank.
Well, I think the medical ethics of tailoring diseases to give them to people to make them worse are clearly, that's not medically ethical. And medical ethics is about helping people, preventing human suffering, not exacerbating it. And that's that question certainly has come up in the past with respect to offensive biological weapons. However, these researchers weren't doing this in order to give people the enhanced avian flu. They were doing it for research to understand it better. That's a different set of ethical questions.
But I think Gene is not asking to make people's health worse in the immediate case, but simply to make the threat of these diseases more threatening, which this certainly has become by the mutation that was done. Now, what are the ethics of that? When you know that the information that you glean, it's what we're wrestling with right now, may not stay secret.
Well, somebody needs to make a decision. The funding agencies, the institutions, the researchers. When the decision is made to do this research, somebody needs to decide, is this research that's worth doing? And to do that, you would weigh the potential benefits defensively and understanding better the virulence and the transmissibility mm-hmm. and being able to do something against it versus the risk that it will leak out. You'd also have to weigh into that the possibility that other people are going to be doing this anyway, and so it wouldn't matter very much whether you did it or didn't do it. It's a trying to figure out the consequences of the actions and whether those consequences on balance are good or bad is a really difficult, complicated issue.
Does it bother you ethically, if your ethics go in this direction, your studies, Hank Greeley, that the research will now be locked up in terms of the ethics of science and doing science and sharing science? Is that ethically troubling or ethically correct given the risks?
I think it's probably both. It's probably both ethically troubling and in this context, my own sense is it's probably the correct answer here. Look, this is one of those genuinely hard problems. We've got a couple of very strong principles and interests that are in conflict. Science needs to be and is best done when it's open and people can review all the dotted I's and crossed T's of every piece of work. On the other hand, we need to protect to the extent we can. We all have a moral duty to try to avoid an out-of-control biowarfare holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two, they're both valid concerns. In the context of dual-use biological research, they are in conflict with each other. There's never going to be a perfect solution to the problem. The solution that the NSABB embodies, I think, is arguably a least bad solution.
Or maybe getting there. Let me take a call, if I may, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jim is calling. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a sort of a basic question about a problem that I can't quite articulate very well, clear up in my mind, and maybe you people can help. There is, I know, pure science, and there is something which I guess we would call applied science or engineering. And I'm trying to distinguish, like, if they were developing materials for the stealth bomber, a newer, more high-tech, more stealthy stealth bomber
right.
or something,
mm-hmm.
that would be secret.
It'd be classified from the get-go.
Discussion. Mm.
Yep.
Beg your pardon?
It would be classified from the get-go.
Right. And I understand, at some level, I feel a difference between pure science. I was a physics undergraduate 18 zillion years ago,
okay.
So I know. But I just, someone needs to, so I can understand there is a difference. I can't put my finger on what it is, why this is, why this raises the issue, and stealth bomber materials wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, let us go. That's a great question, Jim, and I've been wrestling with it myself because I'm reading, you know, all sides of this. I'm going to bring this to you, Donald Henderson. We've got another listener online saying, to Jim's perspective, he says, look, dispersion of intellectual DIY, do-it-yourself, for nuclear weapons are safeguarded for a reason. Should the world's viral and bacteriological cookbooks deserve less? He says humanity's existence dances on the edge of extinction for any number of things. Why wouldn't you lock this up? On the other hand, here's a little tape, Don, of the Dutch scientist, Ron Fortier, right in the middle of this, talking with the BBC yesterday about this case. And he said he's going to go along with the government recommendations to withhold details of his experiments. But the Dutch researcher said he's troubled by this restraint.
This is unprecedented in the scientific field, as far as I'm aware, and so it touches on academic freedom and freedom of press. This is new, and I don't think that this is the way to go with scientific publication.
Help us understand this, Donald Henderson. How is this different from keeping stealth bomber technology classified and research locked up?
Well, nuclear. In this case, we are certainly dealing with an unprecedented situation. We've never had anything quite like this. We will have gradations of it in other areas, but there's a question here. We do have a pattern, something called the Human Subjects Research Trial Committees in every university, looking at the human trials and are they being done ethically and are they going to have a productive endpoint, et cetera, et cetera. There might be an approach here is to use something comparable to this in terms of having a review of the science before it's done. And I think this is done, I think, to a degree with some of the granting agencies. But this is not what I would call a uniform examination.
I want to poke in there a little more, Hank Greeley. I've got more on people online on Facebook. Joseph says, Tom, there's already a precedent for withholding research information. The military keeps secret research all the time, nuclear technology, for example. So why is this different, Hank? You hear the Dutch scientists saying it's different. You've got this British scientist, the Imperial College, saying it's a big brother stepping in here. Why is it different that this information be redacted?
I think it's different because of the different social contexts of the research involved. The Manhattan Project, leading to nuclear weapons in World War II, was not only funded by the federal government, but took place in special enclaves out in Los Alamos and other places where everything was federally controlled, militarily controlled, everything was classified. Nuclear weapons research remains classified. Biology, on the other hand, is being done all over the world with funding from tens of thousands of sources. And the most pure, somebody asked about the difference between pure and applied. Well, in biology, if that difference makes sense anywhere, it makes less sense in biology because the most non-applied piece of research can end up having significant applications and significant ramifications. So the possibility of dual use, you're not going to be inventing a toaster and it turns out to have implications for stealth bomber technology. Not very likely.
Mm-hmm.
But with hundreds of thousands of biology researchers all over the world, many of the things they do could turn out to have ramifications for biological warfare. So I don't think the difference is one of dangerousness per se. It's a difference of the research context in which these are set. Classic military research is set in a controlled and controllable environment. Biological research is everywhere. It's being done for intellectual purposes. It's being done for pharmaceutical and biotech purposes.
Yep.
It can't be controlled in the same way. Now, that's not necessarily a downside. Secret research often isn't very good research, or it isn't as good research because it's not subject to the kind of searching scrutiny by peers that goes on in the public world.
Right.
So the advantage of the more open system is it probably produces better science. The disadvantage in a context where there is this dual-use possibility is it opens some serious risks.
Boy, this is fascinating terrain. Hillary Clinton was talking about this a couple of months ago. This was at the Biological Weapons Convention in Geneva. This was September 7th, and I've got a little tape of her warning about the threat, apparently to people skeptical of the U.S. concerns, warning about the threat of biological weapons.
Now, I know there are some in the international community who have their doubts about the odds of a mass biological attack or major outbreak. They point out that we have not seen either so far and conclude the risk must be low. But that is not the conclusion of the United States, because there are warning signs and they are too serious to ignore.
Too serious to ignore. And she went on to say that Al-Qaeda is actively recruiting, quoting Hillary Clinton here, brothers with degrees in microbiology or chemistry to develop a weapon of mass destruction. And there you can be pretty scared in a hurry. Saad in Los Angeles, California. Saad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, are we over-exaggerating the danger of this research? Now, what I understand is that bird flu virus is probably made more effective to mammalian or human cells.
Yeah.
But that's in the lab. Does that translate into more danger in the field? Like, what about host defense? What about the immune system? Are we over-exaggerating the danger of this research?
It's a good question. Donald Henderson?
I certainly don't think we are. We have certainly experience with influenza virus. We've seen 1918. We've seen the effects of the H5N1 in humans. So I don't think we are. This is a very bad disease, and I think we really have to treat this as a situation which is maybe special. There aren't going to be a lot of these, but I think we better take it more seriously than we have.
Mike in Stowe, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
All right, I guess.
I know it's a little horrifying to talk about, but I have a lot of concerns about the security of these entities, these agents and viruses. There's a lot of history of this stuff getting out, going back to the anthrax cases, going back to smallpox, which had been eradicated back in the 70s and kept in two locations, one in Siberia, one at the CDC, and smallpox appeared in Afghanistan during the 1980 war. So that's another, I'm reminded of that book. Everyone should read it again by Kurt Vonnegut, Cat's Cradle. Fantastic book. The agent was called Ice Nine. And, one of the atomic bomb creators, was playing Cat's Cradle when the test bomb went off. And he, released this Ice Nine into any bit of water and it freezes the entire planet and everyone dies. And somehow, of course, it does get out and one little drop falls into a bathtub and goes through the pipe and all the way to the oceans, and that's the end of humanity.
Mike, you make the point very vividly. I think we've got it, yes. And yet, we are on many, many fronts. As science has expanded, we're dealing with very powerful dynamics, and humans are interacting with them. This is a kind of a frightening one, but let me hold your point right there and get one more here from Pittsburgh. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In the field of information technology, there's a saying, security through obscurity is not security at all. The turnaround time for, or the bar to entry for biological research is getting lower and lower and lower.
Yeah.
More and more people are getting into it, which means that we can't just hide this stuff and, pretend it doesn't exist and pretend it's not going to get out. Just because we hide the new H5N1 virus doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to come up with their own version or their own version of something else. What we need to be doing is working on, turning this stuff around more quickly.
So push faster, push harder forward on science, figure it out ahead of the curve. Well, let's pick that up as well. I appreciate your call, Aaron. Bruce Alberts, let me bring that to you, if I may. And let me bring it to you in this context. You publish. You're an editor. Your whole existence, editor-in-chief, Science Magazine, is to get research out there. Now we live in an age of such advanced science and such highly developed concern about security. Are you concerned that the merger of these two things, security concerns and science, is going to slow down, gum up, retard science? Our caller Aaron says, push it ahead, stay ahead of threats.
Tom, thanks. Just before the break, I was trying to say that we could take advantage of this and suggest a specific mechanism.
Good.
After 9/11, I think broadly we need to mobilize a broader group of outstanding scientists to work on this flu problem. I mean, I think Don's point could be well taken, and cause us to really do something out of the box here. Post 9/11, the Academy ran this workshop on small antivirals and smallpox, which I think could be a model that we could follow here. You get, you know, five experts on flu together with 25 of the best scientists you can find who don't know anything necessarily about flu but have technologies and ways of thinking that are different from those who normally work on flu. And you try to come up with some new approaches to quickly mobilize talent and try to create a defense against the possible outbreak that we now know is much more possible than we had thought. That's the finding of this research, and one could argue that's the benefit of having done this research, is that we are now alerted to this real possibility of bird flu becoming, in the wild, transmissible through aerosols and thereby killing huge numbers of people.
But maybe in a high-security age, we can't even have that conversation because we're afraid who's listening, how they might use what they learn.
Well, the workshop would be to focus on how to get defenses going. I think that kind of dual use of this kind of information is critical. And that's why we need to get the information out to the right people. But
what issue of Science Magazine will this research be in? Do you have any idea at this point?
Well, we're waiting for the government to have a transparent mechanism before we publish. The earliest it will be out is in the middle of January.
Which is not too far, potentially, from now.
Actually, we've been urged by the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity to get it out as soon as we can, because they want to alert the world to this possibility.
Incredible times we live in. I don't think we got a solution here quite today, but we sure learned a lot, and I'm grateful to all three of you for helping us do that. Hank Greeley at the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford University. Thank you very much, Professor Greeley.
My pleasure.
Donald Henderson with the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Thank you, Donald.
Thank you.
And Bruce Alberts, Editor-in-Chief, Science Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.